From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Take Two. Me, Martinez. With a crush of people showing up to hospitals, that means bills for the care will pile up. And if someone isn't working, that, along with life's other expenses, could be a financial backbreaker. But a U.S. Congress member from Orange County has a plan to help protect patients' credit. Plus, if life imitates art, then the Getty Center is on the right track by asking people to look at their art, recreate it with household items, and send them a picture. It's ahead on Take Two. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Ian Martinez. It's Thursday, a lot happening, so let's jump right into it. 18,309. That's how many Californians have tested positive for coronavirus. That's according to Governor Gavin Newsom. A total of 492 have died. But it's not all doom and gloom. In his briefing this afternoon, Governor Newsom took a moment to spotlight a 1.9% drop in ICU admissions.
I caution anybody to read too much into that one point of data. But nonetheless, it is encouraging, and it just again reinforces the incredible work that all of you are doing to practice physical distancing. The stay at home is working in the state of California. That curve, it has been bent in this state, but it's also again been stretched.
Newsom says the state continues to remain vigilant, and you should too. All right, now, it was just last month, but the California primary feels really like a lifetime ago. With local results now certified, several highly competitive contests have taken shape. But politicians are facing a new reality: no in-person contact with volunteers, donors, or potential voters. KPCC's Libby Denkman reports on how local candidates are campaigning in the time of coronavirus.
The seats are mostly empty on a recent Sunday at Calvary Chapel of the Harbor in Huntington Beach. Congregants are online, streaming on Facebook Live. Pastor Joe Pettick begins his service by imploring his flock to spend more time with God while most daily distractions are put on hold because of COVID-19.
God has our attention, doesn't he? He's stripped away so much, sporting events stripped away, all kinds of things.
Something that's not stripped away, politics. Pastor Joe welcomes Orange County Supervisor Michelle Steele to the stage to share an update on local coronavirus relief efforts.
As you know, Michelle Steele is running for Congress.
Yes.
And we're excited about that. She holds our views, so I'm very blessed by that. We've gotten to know you.
Steele emerged from last month's primary to be the Republican contender to unseat freshman Democrat Harley Ruda in the 48th District, one of the most competitive House races on the national map. Steele says the virus has upended plans for a traditional ground game.
Campaigning is almost stopped, but you know what? I still are communicating with my voters.
Instead of appearing at house parties, meeting donors at fundraising events, or joining volunteers going door to door, the supervisor's current job has her at the county's Emergency Operations Center daily, working with agency heads to bend the curve.
So this is really scary. It's life and death in Orange County.
Shaking hands and kissing babies is out, but events beamed straight into potential voters' homes can still foster intimacy and build support at a safe distance. Like the Sunday service with Pastor Joe, which takes advantage of an executive order from President Trump's first year in office that relaxed rules for churches engaging in political activity. Today, campaigns are also turning to text messages, emails, and social media like never before. Add to that Zoom happy hours for donors, online town halls, and digital organizing trainings for volunteers. The front porch is now virtual. Steele's opponent, Congressman Ruda, is asking campaign volunteers to call their elderly relatives and members of their community to offer help while Orange County is sheltering in place.
What we have seen with our volunteer base is a quick pivot to helping those in need in our community.
The congressman has also criticized Orange County supervisors, including Steele, over the board's response to the pandemic.
Where I do still have significant concerns, I'm fielding calls daily about personal protective equipment being available.
Yet there are pitfalls in appearing overly partisan during a crisis, says campaign consultant John Shalman. He's in charge of former LA City Council President Herb Wesson's bid for an open seat on the powerful County Board of Supervisors. Shalman says the tone of campaigning has to change, at least for now.
This might not be the right time to run these, you know, harsh, negative personal campaigns. This may be more about how can I turn my campaign to be a campaign of service?
It's also not the time to lead with the political fundraising ask, says Lene Richards. She's campaign manager for Wesson's competition, State Senator Holly Mitchell. Instead of celebrating making the top two runoff in November, Mitchell's campaign has been fielding calls about how to apply for unemployment or what seniors who can't leave their houses should do about groceries.
There's an immediate need. And it's an opportunity to show what type of leader you are. How do you show up for people?
This is all uncharted territory. And like most campaign operatives, Richards is still weighing the long-term effects of the virus on voter participation and the role of money in politics.
So I want to just give the Lord a hand for all that you're doing. I know our
back at Pastor Joe's right Sunday now. Service in Huntington Beach, it's clear that even though most aspects of life have moved online, old-fashioned politicking will still find a way.
I believe that you would be great as a congresswoman.
Thank you.
You're a blessing to us.
And thank you for inviting me today.
Yes.
You're very welcome.
Covering politics, I'm Libby Denkman.
Now, we all know that coronavirus is definitely a threat to our health. It can also threaten our finances. Hospital bills for treatment can cost an average of $72,000. That's according to a report by Covered California. And even if a patient is insured, these costs will pile up for the rest of us as premium spikes in our own plan. In a bid to protect people's finances, California Congresswoman Katie Porter has introduced legislation with her colleagues to address medical debt and the havoc it can wreak on people's credit for years. She represents California's 45th District, which includes Irvine and Mission Viejo, and she's with us by phone to explain. Congresswoman, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sure. Okay, just to start, what might life look like for people who get treated for the coronavirus and struggle to afford their medical bills afterward?
So we're going to see very large medical bills because a lot of this care, because we're encouraging people to stay home and not go in, not get treated unless they have really serious symptoms, people who are getting treatment are going to be seen in emergency rooms and they're going to be admitted. And they're going to often need ICU and isolation care. So I think we're looking at medical bills that are going to be easily upwards of $50,000 and $100,000. We also know that for people who do get intubated, who need that ventilator, it's often taking 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days on that ventilator to allow the lungs to heal. So these are going to be sky-high medical bills, and the consequences for people are going to be tremendously difficult on their credit reports and on their ability to re-engage in our economy.
Now, Congresswoman, this bill of yours focuses on protecting people's credit, even if they incur medical debt. Why did you specifically zero in on that?
So the bill is called the Medical Debt Relief Act, and what it would do is remove any paid off medical debt from people's credit reports and then make a 1 year, institute a 1 year waiting period before new medical debt can be reported. And so this creates this time for insurers to figure out how to bill people, for people to make payments, and for the government, the federal government, to step up and pay for coronavirus treatment, which is something I've been fighting for. Nobody chooses to get sick. Nobody wants to get coronavirus. Nobody wants to get cancer, for that matter. And it's not because of an irresponsible borrowing or because of poor planning. And because medical debt isn't a choice, it's not a good predictor of future credit default. So what we're doing is making it even harder for sick people who may lose their job because they're sick to get back into the economy. And because we know that credit reports are also used to screen for jobs in many, many areas.
Does your bill only cover medical debt connected to coronavirus, or is it all medical debt?
It applies to all medical debt, because the reality is multiple studies have shown medical debt is not a good predictor. And that's what a credit score is. It's a predictor of whether or not you're likely to default in the future. And so if other kinds of loans, like if you're late on paying your car payment, that's a good predictor of whether or not you might be late on paying your mortgage. Medical debt shouldn't be in this model, and these gigantic credit reporting agencies shouldn't be collecting medical debt at all. It's not like a doctor should be saying to a patient, hey, I'm not going to treat you for coronavirus because I see you used to have cancer and you didn't pay your whole bill. So there's no place for medical debt in the credit reporting system at all.
So to be clear, if I go skiing and I break my leg, that's part of this as well.
Absolutely. So you should pay, you know, you should pay your bill, your insurer should cover it, all of those things. But putting it into the credit reporting system is simply dragging down the experience of someone who's gotten sick or gotten injured for years to come.
What's the time frame for the debt relief? How far back does it go and how far forward does it extend?
Yep. So it would remove, the bill would remove any old medical debt, period, that has been paid off or has been settled. So if you have prior medical debt and you negotiated with your hospital, you paid that bill, it would take that off your credit report. Once it's off your credit report, it can't be used in your credit score. And then going forward, what this would do is say for the next 365 days, the next year, no medical debt can be reported to these credit reporting agencies. So it basically stops the inflow of medical debt and removes the old medical debt. So it both looks backwards and looks forward. And the idea of having that 1 year going forward is for everyone to be able to see that, in fact, medical debt doesn't make these models less accurate. It's simply a drag on the economic recovery of people who already are trying to struggle with recovering their health.
Talking to California Congresswoman Katie Porter. She represents California's 45th district. Now, the federal stimulus package passed by Congress removed the financial barriers to testing, something that you took the lead on, but the bill did not remove the cost for treatment and hospitalization. Why not?
Well, so it's a failure, to be perfectly honest with you. It absolutely should. And when I had that exchange with the CDC director, Redfield, about why the CDC should pay for testing, the statute that I pointed to would also cover the cost of treatment and isolation and the full treatment scheme that people are needing to recover. So there's Congress should act, should direct that these bills are covered. But to be clear, there's nothing stopping the administration from stepping up right now and making sure that treatment is covered for this pandemic. It's exactly why that regulation exists, is to make sure that the economic harms of a pandemic don't multiply because people can't cover the costs. So I'm frustrated that Congress did not include this in the CARES Act, and I am pushing really hard to make sure it gets included in future legislation. I also received a coronavirus test because I was very sick for a week and had a fever, and I cannot wait to see what kind of bill I get for that test.
Well, let's get into that because, yeah, you had a situation where weeks ago you self-quarantined because you experienced symptoms suggestive of COVID-19. You eventually tested negative for the virus. What was that like in the days where you weren't sure, Congresswoman, whether you had contracted it? Did you feel anxious, fearful? What was going on?
Yeah, I felt very concerned about whether I might have infected other people, including my staff. I had just returned from Washington about 3 or 4 days earlier when I started to feel sick. I did everything that you're supposed to do. I called my provider. I took my temperature. I wrote it down. I took Tylenol, all these things. But when I spiked a fever and sustained that fever, that's when I went in to get tested. And it was scary, but it was also really good for me to see exactly what's going on the ground in healthcare. And for instance, one of the things I noticed is I was directed to go to the hospital, to the regular doctor's office for my test. And I was told that when I got there, I would be screened and given a mask. When I walked in, the two people giving out the masks weren't wearing masks themselves.
Wow. Okay.
And they're asking people whether they need a mask. So they should be assuming that everybody they're engaging with needs one. So, and it wasn't a shortage problem. They were literally giving out masks and yet weren't wearing them themselves. So it was good to see firsthand. And as a single mother, good for me to see how difficult it is to try to care for yourself and care for your family when you fall sick.
On the personal side of this, you mentioned you're a single mother. I mean, many people are in your exact same situation, juggling parenting their kids, schooling their kids, trying to work or maybe find work right now. What's the struggle like for you in doing the exact same thing that many Americans are trying to deal with?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I think that while there are people who are laid off because of this pandemic and unable to work, there's also a segment of people who are having to work harder than ever. This includes our healthcare providers and our nurses, for example, who are being asked to pick up shifts and stay on the job later and do more. And I'm certainly trying to do as much as I can each and every minute to help my constituents and to help our country. So my kids have been really terrific, but, you know, I don't have a big home. People are like, I'm working out of my home office. And I don't have a home office. I have a kitchen. So I'm sitting right here. And right before I got on this interview, I had to tell my 11-year-old, listen, buddy, you got to turn down the video game sounds because it's going to get picked up in my radio interview. So it really is a constant juggle. And I think particularly for the single parents out there, and for people who relied on grandparents or seniors to help them do care, a lot of that safety net for working parents has really fallen apart during this pandemic. And so I think a lot about how much stress a lot of our workers, our essential workers, are under because of schools being closed and child care providers, there being fewer options for child care right now.
Congresswoman, I think a lot of people have been thinking about the Affordable Care Act since this is happening in the United States right now. It's a decade old, but what gaps has this crisis uncovered about how well it does or maybe doesn't work in helping Americans?
One thing I'm really focused on with the Affordable Care Act is the ongoing problems now for a full decade with the coverage of mental health care under the ACA, under the Affordable Care Act. So the ACA mandated that health insurance companies treat physical health and mental health the same. But that is a promise that has failed to come true on the ground. And right now what we're looking at is a lot of people having problems with anxiety, people who are in stressful professions, including PTSD and things for our mental health worker, for our healthcare workers, and their own health insurance companies don't have good networks and don't cover mental health providers. So I have a bipartisan mental health parity bill. I think this has been a problem for 10 years now, but the pandemic hopefully has made clear why we need to hold health insurers' feet to the fire to make sure that they're actually providing coverage for mental health claims.
Well, Governor Newsom made that a big point in his daily briefing yesterday, I believe. The fact that right now that isn't something that's being really talked about. Everyone's at home. Everyone's kind of on top of each other right now. And sometimes that could lead to stressful mental situations.
Absolutely. And look, our mental health professionals, they're frontline workers, and they are doing a great job using remote technology to try to provide continuity of care for people who need mental health. But that doesn't solve the problem that mental health care is not reimbursed at an appropriate rate, that we have a shortage of providers, that these providers are not in network. That is, there's not parity. So anybody who's ever, gotten health insurance and then tried to locate a mental health provider, there essentially are none. Their first appointment is 6 months away. And so it's really important that we ask insurance companies to step up and provide this coverage, because in addition to the need being greater right now, the need is greater and the coverage problems continue to exist.
Congresswoman, just listening to you, it sounds like just the stigma of having something bad on your credit report is driving this. I understand that having credit not be ruined by medical debt is generally the reason for this, but just the stigma of how this appears in your life as life goes on, it seems like that seems to be what's driving you more than anything else.
Well, I think it's that I really, all my years before I became a congresswoman was studying families in bankruptcy and did that work along with then professor. She was my professor, Elizabeth Warren. And one of the things that I heard so many families talk about in the bankruptcy system was they really wanted their creditors to understand why they weren't paying their bills. They weren't paying their bills because somebody got sick, because somebody got cancer, because there was a premature baby, because they were forced out of the workforce to take care of a husband who, for instance, needed oxygen or home health care or dialysis. So I've seen and heard these stories for decades. They pop up in the bankruptcy system, but with this pandemic, I think it's hopefully causing a lot of us to confront in a more honest way the really unfair consequences that are associated with medical debt in our current system.
Katie Porter, Democratic Congresswoman who represents California's 45th District. That includes Irvine and Mission Viejo. Congresswoman, thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right, last week, a longtime KPCC supporter called our CEO, Herb Scannell, to offer a way to keep KPCC funded as our extensive coronavirus reporting continues. That means that today only your donation will be matched dollar for dollar, dollar for dollar. So soak it. Let's get it up and soak it up. Please give us a call, 866-888-5722 or kpcc.org. And thanks. More Take 2 coming right up.
nothing, nothing can ever change this love I have for you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. It's a rainy day here in L.A., but lately the skies have been clearer than ever. On Twitter, Angelenos have been posting photos where you can actually see Catalina Island from Griffith Park. Now, on the surface, it seems like the clear skies are a result of lower pollution levels with less commuting and travel. But according to LAist Ryan Fonseca, the story is a bit more complicated. And Ryan joins us now to talk about the environmental impact of quarantine. Ryan, welcome back.
Hi, A. Thanks for having me.
All right. Now, give us some background on LA's pollution. Now, what are typically the main culprits responsible for the bad air quality?
The main culprits are always going to be transportation-related emissions. So our planes, trains, private cars, they're behind about 80% of our region's air quality problems, according to the experts. So obviously right now people aren't commuting or flying as much. And it's something that most people might not realize, too, is the impact of less trucks at our ports. When trade from China really slowed down in toward the end of February, a lot of our truck traffic at the ports of LA and Long Beach really slowed down, so we weren't having as many of those big diesel-burning trucks on the road. So that definitely reduced emissions there played a role as well.
So planes, trains, and automobiles, a good movie and also the lead reason that's responsible for all this. Now, just looking around outside, it seems like the air is cleaner and clearer. Is that a result of just lower transportation-related emissions?
Clearer, definitely yes, right? I know a few weekends back, I was driving down to the Glendale area from Pasadena. So you go over the 134, you come down through Eagle Rock, and I looked out and I could see the ocean very clearly from the top of the mountain. And I would just had to gasp, like, wow, I can't believe I can see this. So it's definitely a lot clearer out there. Cleaner is a bit more complicated, though. So we, of course, would assume that clearer skies are a result of how much we've been cutting down now. Because, so many of us, our work commutes are limited to trips from the bed to the couch, right? That, of course, means fewer cars on the road. That, of course, using logic to figure out, that means that emissions are down. So I've been in touch with the South Coast Air Quality Management District about this, and officials there tell me we really need to pump the brakes. They're still gathering data to understand just how much of our clean, clear air is due to fewer cars on the road and how much to credit all the rain we've been getting.
Really, Ryan? So who did you talk to about this?
I spoke with Sunny Ivy. She teaches chemical and environmental engineering at UC Riverside, and she's been looking into how nitrogen dioxide levels are changing right now. And just for some background, nitrogen dioxide, or NO2 for short, is another pollutant that we produce by driving cars and trucks, and it's also generated by power plants and factories. So based on her findings, since around the time people began to quarantine at higher levels, NO2 levels in the greater LA area have dropped up to 50% in some places, especially during the evening commute. So NO2 forms ozone, which we call smog, of course. And really simple terms, vehicle emissions both cause smog and they turn around and eat it up later in the day. So the end result is usually that ozone levels decrease in the evening. But right now, because there are fewer cars on the road, especially in the evening, the smog that's forming throughout the day and moving into the Inland Empire area is actually lingering in the air longer. So parts of San Bernardino and Riverside counties are actually having higher levels of ozone at night than they're used to.
Okay, so let me get this straight. NO2 levels are down, but smog is lingering. So, Ryan, when you add it all up, is the air quality as good as it looks?
That's sort of still the question that's out right now. The science is still out on, exactly how clean it is. And again, there's a lot of different kinds of pollution that they look at. So again, NO2 levels being down, but ozone being up in some parts of the air, at least according to the last week of March. So it's still one of these things where it's kind of still too early to tell exactly what the short-term impacts are going to be. The main takeaway I would say is I think people, but especially news media right now, should be cautious of praising any perceived positive environmental impacts of the quarantine. One expert I talked to said that environmental advocates and regulatory agencies he works with have expressed that they really don't see any silver lining here. Because, of course, the health crisis and the massive disruption to how we work and travel isn't the way anyone wants to accomplish cleaner air. So, it's really not about less travel. It's about how we're traveling.
Now, you also took a look at the impact long-term air pollution is having now in the age of coronavirus. And it turns out there's a study about that from Harvard. What does it show?
Right. There's another story here about sort of the long-term impact, being exposed to bad air over time and how that impacts people's health and immune system. So researchers from Harvard released a study just this week, and they looked at about 3,000 counties across the U.S. where the vast majority of COVID-19 deaths are happening. They also factored in population size, number of hospital beds, a number of individuals being tested for coronavirus, plus stuff like weather and then socioeconomic and behavioral variables like smoking. So they held that data against about 15 years worth of county data that looked at exposure to particulate matter air pollution. That pollution is referred to as PM2.5. And these are the tiny particles that are, again, mostly produced by, not surprisingly, us. They're formed from emissions generated by cars and trucks, power plants, industrial sites. So we're all breathing this in on a daily basis, and that's been linked to some harmful health effects, including asthma, decreased lung functions, and complications for people with heart or lung disease. So many of those same conditions put people who contract COVID-19 at a higher risk of falling severely ill.
Ryan, how does all that come back to us here in Southern California?
Right. Well, we're known for our trademark infamous bad air and smog. So it's really concerning for Southern California because the South Coast Air Basin, which includes Los Angeles, Riverside, San Bernardino counties, those counties regularly rank among the very worst in the nation for this kind of air pollution. So again, based on the Harvard study, we can expect that our counties, our local region will see an increased death rate for coronavirus as a result.
That's LAist Ryan Fonseca. You can read Ryan's stories about Southern California's air pollution at LAist.com. That's LAIST.com. Ryan, thanks a lot.
Thanks, eh?
Moving on, teaching students with disabilities is hard enough in normal times. Now try doing it online. The coronavirus has forced this challenge on public schools across California. Many school districts are scrambling to find ways to deliver common special education services remotely. But in the meantime, many parents say these services like physical or behavior therapy are not happening. And even when they resume, some parents wonder if they can be as effective online. KPCC's Kyle Stokes reports.
Aaron Coleman is 6 years old, has a genetic syndrome that experts have yet to identify, and his mom, Kelly, says that medically, developmentally, cognitively,
he is incredibly delayed compared to his same-aged peers.
But Aaron can walk on his own, he communicates a little, and he has a lot of energy.
He's an enthusiastic little guy about most things.
Maybe too much so when it comes to computers.
Aaron is a child, when he sees a computer, gets very excited, and he wants to bang, bang, bang on the computer and touch it and tap it and lick it and carry it around.
Almost anything but sit still in front of it. Now, in school, he'd have an adult with him at all times to help with this behavior. Aaron also gets therapies for his communication and motor skills. But with his LA Unified School campus closed, none of that is happening for Aaron. So for now, the only way he's likely to get any of those services is through a computer.
But when you are trying to teach your child, don't touch the computer, there's really not a lot of other learning going on.
Roughly one out of every seven public school students in California has an identified disability, ranging from dyslexia to autism to Aaron's unnamed genetic condition. For each kid, each year, parents and schools negotiate an individualized education plan, or an IEP. An IEP spells out all of the services that a student needs to get what's called a free and appropriate public education. For Aaron, that includes the adult helper, the therapies, a special class. And IEP services are protected by federal law, which State Superintendent Tony Thurmond says is still true while campuses are closed.
Let me make that clear. The federal government has said that districts are in fact allowed and encouraged to provide special education through distance learning.
This will be our greatest challenge.
LAUSD Superintendent Austin Buettner.
The technologies and teaching practices are not well established in these areas.
But Buettner also says the district is making progress. He says special education teachers are recording video lessons for students. He also said in a video statement on Monday,
occupational and physical therapists, as well as speech and language teachers, are providing services to students via teleconferencing.
That statement confused Kelly Coleman. Though Aaron's special ed classroom teacher has been in touch, his specialized therapies have not been happening.
We have not been communicated that there will be or is a plan, but the hope is that there will be a plan after spring break.
Other LAUSD parents have told KPCC basically the same thing. One possible reason for the delay, schools are worried about legal liability. Remember, federal law guarantees IEP services. But even as schools push to resume those services, a lot of educators are coming to acknowledge a sobering reality. Here's how Buettner put it.
There may be some students for whom there is no good substitute for face-to-face contact.
Coleman's son may be one of those students. Even in normal times, being in a classroom setting helps Aaron regulate his behaviors.
We see Aaron regress even over a holiday break, even as a parent who puts in a great deal of effort. There is no way I can give him everything that he needs at home and without his services, and I'm confident that he will regress during this time.
Many of Southern California's 376,000 students with disabilities are in the same position, with their parents and their teachers desperately trying to make up at home for the lost routine and structure of school. Covering education, I'm Kyle Stokes.
I remember last month when we were fundraising, we were able to meet our goals, our original goals, so thank you for that. The thing is, we know that the impact of COVID-19 will be lasting a long time. The pandemic has really affected all aspects of daily life, and as a result, for us here at KPCC, we've lost some contributions, including those from corporate sponsors. You know that our newsroom, you've heard it, and all the shows, we're working round the clock to ensure that you have reliable, fact-based news so that you're informed, fully informed. And your support right now will be matched dollar for dollar thanks to a $25,000 donation from an anonymous donor. Please give right now, kpcc.org or 866-888-5722. More Take Two coming right up. Now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC, I'm A. Martinez. California officials are calling this week a critical one in the battle against the novel coronavirus. In Los Angeles County and elsewhere in the state, health officials are urging people to stay home and, if possible, to arrange for the delivery of groceries and other necessities. KPCC's Stephanie O'Neill takes us to the Ventura County town of Ojai, where one resident is providing free shopping for those most at risk.
Bread, bananas, celery, apples, raspberries.
Nigel Chisholm spends a portion of every day grocery shopping for other people.
Potatoes, onions, carrots. Somebody's making a stew. I'll have some of that.
After closure of non-essential businesses shuttered his wine bar, the 58-year-old Ojai resident began looking for ways to help those in need.
And so I was just driving down to L.A., thinking to myself, you know, I really need to be doing something. There's a limited amount that one can do in this situation because you're not supposed to be around people so much.
And so we thought, why not offer free grocery shopping and deliveries to local people who, because of health challenges or age, can't or shouldn't shop for themselves? People like Ojai residents Debbie and John Perry, both of whom are over 65 and among those public health experts say should stay home to protect their health.
We thought, how are we going to manage this? We're not supposed to go out. And my husband's older. I'm older.
Her daughter, who lives in L.A., found Chisholm's free grocery shopping service online. Now, when Perry needs groceries, she logs into his Facebook page called Ojai Shopping Cart. And with a few clicks of her keyboard, she's all set.
You give him a list before 10, and then he shops between 10 and 2, and then he delivers it with gloves and mask on. And it's just been great.
Perry says Chisholm even taught her to use PayPal, which allows her and his other customers to reimburse them for groceries without a cash exchange that could spread the virus. Health experts say the growing number of grocery shopping services like this are an important tool in flattening the curve, which essentially means slowing down the number of COVID-19 cases so hospitals aren't overwhelmed.
Any way that we can minimize the number of people that have to go to grocery stores is helpful.
Dr. Courtney Gedingel is an infectious medicine specialist and a policy researcher at the RAND Corporation. She says for everyone, even the young and healthy, reducing the number of contacts with people outside your household can save lives.
It's about the sort of number of interactions that you have. So anything you can reasonably do to try and cut down on that, whether that's one member of the family shopping for multiple households or whether it's going at off times.
Or whether it's using a grocery delivery service. Nigel Chisholm now wears a mask along with rubber gloves as he shops for Ojai residents, popping in and out of several local markets in his quest to fulfill their grocery needs. And sometimes that's pretty easy to do.
Yeah, we got that, 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 we got that. What's next on the list?
But other times, not so much.
All right, so this is where the challenges come in now.
What are you looking for?
The Morning Farms veggie sausage links. Apparently they're in a green box. I don't even know where to go find them.
He eventually does find their shelf. It's empty. The stores run out of that brand. But Nigel Chisholm says, no worries. That happens a lot in these pandemic days. So he quickly finds a substitute and carries on. I'm Stephanie O'Neill.
And Stephanie O'Neill's reporting is supported through a health journalism fellowship at the Natural Hazard Center, funded by Direct Relief, a nonprofit humanitarian aid group. Moving on, for places that thrive on in-person visits, this quarantine thing isn't so hot. For example, museums. But the Getty Center in LA has captivated California and the world with a simple project online. Look at any piece of their collection and then recreate it in your own home and send them a picture. And the responses have been overwhelming and a lot of fun. We have one of the people behind the idea, Annalisa Steffen, who's the head of digital content strategy for the Getty Center. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
All right, now listeners can see examples of this by finding Getty Museum on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. But give us a sample. Let's start with one of your favorites, which is based on a sculpture of a harp player. Tell us about what that piece looks like and then how someone recreated it.
So it's an ancient Greek sculpture. It's small. It's of a harp player, and there's an arcing piece of marble, very simple, that delineates the shape of the harp. And then one of our followers took that inspiration and posed herself with a canister vacuum, posing the canister, the tube of the vacuum, in exactly the right position, and then took a photo of herself at exactly the correct angle to look just like the sculpture, but yeah, you know, at life size. So super creative.
You know what that tells me is that art is everywhere. It's all around us. We just have to kind of be creative. Okay, so give us just a couple of maybe more examples of maybe creative and surprising ways that people have used items from their homes.
Yeah, so one family that we saw on Twitter, they happened to be at breakfast and they heard about the challenge. And they literally used the breakfast foods that they had around them and things that were in their kitchen. So they were at their kitchen table. So they picked some dry lasagna noodles. They had some basil stems that they had used for last night's pasta. And with the child driving the whole process, they put together what is an amazing recreation of a Renaissance manuscript page. And the lasagna noodles look kind of like handwriting on their edges. So just so clever.
Now, the Getty Center closed its doors last month. Obviously, though, there was a desire by your team to still engage with the public in some way. Why is this important for the museum and its staff?
We heard from our audiences that they really missed museums as community places. We heard from people saying, oh, you know, I'm so sad because it was going to be my birthday in April and I was looking forward to going there as my special place. So we knew there was a, not just that people couldn't see art, but that there was a missing sense of community. And we were hoping that our online content could fill some tiny gap in that area. So we were really thrilled when people not only began posting, but more importantly, cheering each other on and liking and favoriting and saying, I love this. You're so creative and talking to complete internet strangers around the world about it. It's been really heartwarming.
Where did this specific idea come from? Take us behind the blank canvas on this one.
When we were thinking about this, we saw a Dutch Instagram account called Between Art and Quarantine, and they had are the originators, so full credit to them and their genius for coming up with a three objects thing, because the challenge, the key to the challenge is that it needs to be fun and easy and needs to be something you can just look around your room and say, what could I do? That was sort of the origin of the challenge. And when we posted it, we thought it could be, you know, fun. I thought maybe if we got 30, that would be pretty great. And we've it's got to be 30,000 or more.
Careful
well,
what
more.
You wish for, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's been great. So in addition to all the public submissions you see, we've got so many by DM on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. So it's just still going strong.
Talking to Annalisa Steffen, who's head of digital content strategy for the Getty Center. Folks are taking pieces of art at the Getty and recreating them with just household items. You've reached people globally with this. Give us a sense of how far-reaching it is.
So we've seen definitely submissions from all over Europe, France and Italy in particular, lots of submissions there. Seen some from India, from Australia. There's a famous Leonardo da Vinci painting of a woman holding an ermine, which is like a ferret, and it's in Krakow, Poland. And so we've seen folks really proud of their heritage and having that piece in their national collection who've been submitting from Krakow. So it's just been all over the place. And we've seen people submitting who just didn't even know that we were involved or didn't know that the Rijksmuseum, which was one of the original geniuses behind this idea, was involved. So it really became not about us at all. People are using art collections, certainly, but they're just using art that they love or that sort of evoke something for them.
You know, I know us here in California, we're creative, artistic types. So I'm wondering why you think this project seemed to resonate, not just with us here, but with people all over the world.
You know, I think art plays a role in our imaginations, whether or not you're a frequent museum goer or not. I mean, if you say to someone, what's an artwork that speaks to you? What's a favorite? Everyone has one, whether it's a famous painting or something that their child made. And so I also think that creativity really plays a role in these times. You know, we've heard from folks that literally spent the entire day on this, and I think it creates a sense of meaning. It's a way to make sense of these crazy times that we're in and make sense of the strange objects that we find ourselves surrounded with that we've collected over the years. You know, like one of my favorites too is a recreated Chagall, and the creator took a blue dust pan and just and positioned that against a cat, and it looks exactly like the Chagall painting. So, you know, what does this blue dustpan mean in our lives today? You know, and I think that there's really a hunger for meaning and a hunger for creativity and art, and having community live on and our community spaces live on online during this time.
Now, Annalisa, far be it from me to tell you what to do at the Getty Center, but I'm thinking when the day comes and, you know, the center reopens and we all kind of start heading back to normal, how about getting some of the best ones and making them live art displays?
Ooh, live art displays. Now, that's a first. So we've gotten some requests for an exhibition,
yeah.
A book, a coffee table book, actually, we've got a quest for, but live tableaus, that could be pretty fun, right? Because we could see the starring dustpan mm-hmm. and the starring vacuum in the flesh. That's actually really fun. I'll have to think about that one.
That's Annalisa Steffen, head of digital content strategy for the Getty Center. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Back in March, we met our fundraising goal. Thank you so much for that. But the thing is, the impact of COVID-19 is going to be very long-lasting. This pandemic has really affected all aspects of daily life. So us here at KPCC, we have lost some contributions, including those from corporate sponsors. So we need your help right now. Please give us a call, 866-888-5722. That's 866-888-5722. Or call us at kpcc.org. Thanks. More Take Two coming right up.
Young girls, they do get weary wearing that same old shaggy dress, yeah, yeah.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The pandemic has been disastrous for the music industry, canceling all festivals and tours for the foreseeable future. And yet, listening to music has never felt more necessary, and new music continues to get made. Next month, the East LA quartet Chicano Batman will release their new album, Invisible People. It's an ambitious work that pays homage to their West Coast roots and also brings a message of social justice. Two of the band members spoke with Take Two about the record and how they're coping in these uncertain times.
This is Eduardo Arenas, bass player of Chicano Batman.
This is Carlos Arevalo, guitar player for Chicano Batman.
I would say that we come from very diverse backdrops in terms of musical styles. I see you dancing in the morning. It's like, it could not be more diverse. These songs, especially on the new album, like they have riptides. There's all kinds of things that happen on it. And I think that's just a reflection of our relationship.
One of the big reference points musically for us was like soulies, old school soul records that you would hear on Sunday evenings. Those were definitely something that are just for me ingrained. Also though, I grew up listening to Dr. Dre, that G-Funk sound, that whole West Coast hip-hop style.
Totally. DJ Quick, N.W.A. Yeah. All this stuff. It's like, we didn't have a choice. This is the crib on the west side. I mean, not West LA. That's, I don't know if they were listening to Ice Cube, you know, but on the east side, we were listening to Ice Cube and rancheras and cumbias, the backyard barbecue vibe, you know, Art LeBeau.
And on the Art LeBeau connection tonight, we have a special song.
Followed by Los Bukis. I mean, that's the soundtrack to the carne asada. This stuff is not stuff that we intentionally interject into our music. It's just part of our DNA growing up in Southern California.
Yeah, so Invisible People is the title of the album. I was driving around with Bardo one day in his car, and I told him, you know, I have an idea for a song. I already have the title. It's called Invisible People. Invisible people, we're tired of living in the dark. I explained to him the thesis of the song. I was like, it really bothers me how Latinos are just unappreciated and unseen in the media, on television and movies. And it bothers me. Now, we decided to name the album that, not solely for making a social justice political statement. It's kind of an album title that we felt like could mean whatever you want it to mean. But that's just what I think. How about you, Eduardo?
That was a great answer. I don't think mine could be much better than that. Our new single called Color of My Life, it's only an example of what we can do as a powerhouse. And I'm not talking about four Latinos in a band. I'm talking about four humans going out and reaching for the stars. Are you a lucid dream? That's what it seems. I'm not really sure if it's real. I mean, we're trying to cultivate something that we feel is new and fresh. And this is just a taste of the rest of the album. And it's crazy that we might have to wait a while to release the album because of all the stuff going on.
We were doing a recording session. Eduardo came in and was like, hey man, he's like, the NBA is canceled. They just canceled it because of coronavirus. That was when it was real, right there for me. I was like, no way. Soon after that, I started really thinking about, what am I going to do? I'm going to quarantine myself. And so I was just thinking, what can I do to connect with our fans in this time where I can't physically see them or play a show? And I thought, hey, maybe I could do a guitar tutorial. I had seen a lot of people wanting to learn this song of ours we have called Cycles of Existential Rhyme from our second full-length record, and kids would play it and they would tag me on social media. There'd be little notes amiss here or there, and I was like, you know what, I want to teach them the right way. So I held a live stream and it went over really well, and it was a way to connect that I've never done before, and I don't know if it would happen in any other circumstance than what we're in right now. So it was a beautiful thing to engage with the fans in that way, through music.
I think right now it's time to do all the things you always wanted to do but never had a chance. You know, get into Duke Ellington. You know, get into Tito Puente. See what he does on the timbales. Understand why Celia Cruz is a queen. No, we have time. We have time to think about and a lot of space to really let things sink in right now. I don't know. It's some kind of like a mental revolution going on right now. But there's two sides to every story, you know, and I think we have to make light of all the positive stuff that we can right now and not let the fear really dominate our psyche, because then we're all going to get sick.
It doesn't bother me. Just leave it on the table. Now do you need a glass? It all seems like a fable, yeah. Whatever you feel, I feel just the same.
That was Eduardo Arenas and Carlos Arevalo from Chicano Batman. Their album Invisible People is out in May, and that piece was produced by KPCC's Jonathan Shiflett. All right, if you missed any part of Take Two, you're in luck. Just go wherever you get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media at Take Two. I'm there as well, at AMartinezLA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.